Well, good evening, brothers and sisters and young people. Well, do you recall last class we dealt with Daniel chapter 9, and tonight we hope to deal with Daniel chapter 11, and you may be wondering what happened to chapter 10. Well, the answer is quite simple, really. There's so many verses in chapter 11, it's almost impossible to get through chapter 11 in one night, and it would be a bit of an injustice to try and do that. So tonight we hope to get to verse 39 of chapter 11 and deal with the remaining five or six verses of chapter 11 next week. So that's what we're hoping to do. But let's just make a few comments about chapter 10 before we skip over it. There's a couple of things that I'd like to bring to your attention. You'll recall in Daniel chapter 2 that Nebuchadnezzar saw a vision of a man. Well, in Daniel chapter 10, Daniel sees a vision of a man as well, but it's a very different vision. The one that Nebuchadnezzar saw was a colossus of human pride. The man that Daniel saw, we read in Daniel chapter 10 and verse 5, is a certain man. Now that word certain there means one. It was, the expression used is, it was the man of one. In other words, it was a vision or a symbolic representation of the multitudinous body of Christ. So what a contrast to the colossus that Nebuchadnezzar saw in chapter 2. We're told that when Daniel saw this vision, he was beside the river Hiddekel. Now, the river Hiddekel, we know in Genesis chapter 2, flowed from eastward from the garden in Eden. There's something else that was eastward in Eden, or relative to Eden, and that was the cherubim that God had placed there. And when you compare the description of the cherubim in Ezekiel chapter 1 with the description of the multitudinous body of Christ in Daniel chapter 10, there's a striking similarity. And it may have been, brothers and sisters, that Daniel was given this vision in the very place where that cherubim appeared in Genesis chapter 2. There's just one final point I want to make about Daniel chapter 10 before we move on, and that is this: that the vision of the multitudinous body of Christ was given to Daniel to encourage and inspire him. And the question to us, I believe, is to what extent do our brothers and sisters feature in our vision of the future? That's what was given to Daniel to encourage him. And we can ask ourselves, who features in our vision of the future? Is it just ourselves, or perhaps our family or extended family, or is it all of our brothers and sisters? It was in Daniel's case. A wonderful thought to contemplate. That's all we're going to say about chapter 10. That's all we've got time for. We're going to move into chapter 11 now. And I'm sure we've all read Daniel chapter 11 many times. It's the most detailed prophecy, not only in the book of Daniel, but in the whole Bible. It's striking, the level of detail, of prophetic detail that's there. So much so that many critics have said, look, there's just no way that this prophecy could have been given before it took place. It has to have been written afterwards. Well, there's good reason to say that it wasn't. This prophecy appeared in the Septuagint version of the Bible, and which was written in the 2nd and 3rd centuries BC, and many of the events that are in this chapter took place after that version of the Bible was translated. That's not something we need to concern ourselves with tonight. There could be no greater internal evidence, brothers and sisters and young people, of the veracity of the Bible than this chapter. Think about the level of detail that's here for us. It predicts wars, alliances, treaties, rulers of dynasties, arranged marriages, bribery, taxation, captives, booty, assassinations, victories and defeats. And you stop and think about that. If you were the angels and God said, here's the blueprint that I want you to implement, how remarkable is that, that these events just didn't happen? God knew in advance that they were going to take place, but the angels actually had to make this happen. And I find that really remarkable, especially when back in Daniel chapter 10 we read that in verse 13, the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood Michael 21 days. So even Michael the archangel had to work and be challenged at times by the free will of those that he was trying to direct the lives of. But even more remarkable is the fact that within this chapter is woven moral principles for all of us to give us inspiration. So what's the structure of this chapter? Excuse me, I've for some reason had that message pop up during the last couple of weeks. So what's the structure of this chapter? Well, what we find is that in Daniel chapter 11, well, actually, Daniel chapter 8, 9 and 11, they deal with just three of the five horns of the goat. So the Ptolemaic horn, the Seleucid horn, and this little horn here, which, as we've seen from Daniel chapter 8, was Rome. The Ptolemaic and Seleucid horns are the dynasties of two of Alexander's generals, as you might recall. And in Daniel chapter 11, the Seleucid horn is referred to as the king of the north, and the Ptolemaic horn is referred to as the king of the south. And the little horn is referred to in various different ways, as we'll see in a little while. There's four distinct sections in Daniel chapter 11, and I think it's important that we be able to see the structure here. The first four verses are really just a preface to the chapter. They're an introduction to tell us about the division of Alexander's empire, and that really introduces the king of the north and the king of the south. Verses 5 to 29 talk about the Seleucid-Ptolemaic wars in relation to natural Israel. And what we're going to see is that there were other wars that took place between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies that aren't recorded in chapter 11. These are wars that had relation to natural Israel. Perhaps what's most important to us tonight that we're going to spend a lot of time on is looking at verses 30 to 35. That describes the war against spiritual Israel. The last group of verses, most of which we hope to deal with next week, verses 36 to 45, it now focuses on the little horn, this little horn up here, this that came out of the Seleucid horn, so far as its religious policy is concerned and its military conquests. And that's, we can further subdivide that section into verses 36 to 39 in its Christian Roman phase, and finally in verses 40 to 45, which we hope to deal with next week, in its Russian phase. No doubt, as I said, we've all read Daniel chapter 11 many times, and if we're not familiar with it, it can just seem as a long historical account of these battles to and fro between the king of the north and the king of the south. But, you know, that's not really true. It's not a record, a continuous historical record of events during that period of time. Let's just have a look briefly at the chronology of Daniel chapter 11. This slide covers the first 35 verses. The first observation we can make is that the Seleucid dynasty lasted till 65 BC and the Ptolemaic dynasty lasted till 30 BC. But Daniel chapter 11 only deals with a portion of that history. So just that portion there, you can see the dates for yourself. It's only a segment of the history of those two dynasties. The record in Daniel chooses to omit two major wars that occurred prior to 250 BC, and it also omits the last 130 years of those Grecian kingdoms. The following six verses, verses 35 to 39, cover just a small period of time, a seven-year period of conflict between the king of the north and the Jews, just a tiny window of time. And you'll notice that it's got nothing to do with the king of the south. It only, that portion of Daniel only covers the king of the north and the Jews. And shortly after that seven-year period, what we find is that the Jews gained independence. So from about 150 thereabouts, the Jews gained independence right through until the time when Herod took over the Judea. Well, that's verses 1 to 35. What about the rest of the chapter? We're just trying to get a big picture view here of Daniel to make a point. So we've seen here that Daniel chapter 11 is only concerned with just part of history. It's not intended to be a full historical account of these two kings. What we find is that there is a significant gap of about 500 years between verses 35 and 36 of the chapter, a gap of about 500 years. And furthermore, within verse 40, there is a gap of some 100 years. So what's all of that telling us? Daniel chapter 11 is not intended to be read as a history book. The material presented is designed to teach moral principles, not history. And so our aim tonight is to discover those principles. As I said, we're going to spend most of our time in the second portion of the reading that Brother Jonathan read for us. But we are going to go through the first 29 verses very briefly, just to give you a bit of a feel for the timing and what it was about. So please understand as we go through this first 29 verses quickly, the reason is so we can focus more on the end of the chapter. Daniel chapter 10, as I think I may have said, Daniel 10 right through until the end of the book is really one continuous section. And chapter 10, if you like, is a preface to those last two chapters. But what we need to note in chapter 10, verse 1, is that this vision that was given to Daniel, which extends right through to the end of the book, was in the third year of Cyrus. That was about 536 BC, so about 3 years after Babylon fell. And it was most likely the last year of Daniel's life. Daniel is now 87 years old, a very old man. Verses 1 to 4 of chapter 11, as we said earlier, are just simply an introduction to the chapter. They describe the breakup of Alexander's kingdom amongst his four generals. And the two that the rest of the chapter deals with are the Ptolemaic and the Seleucid kings, the king of the north and the king of the south. So let's have a look now at these verses from verses 5 through to 29, which deal with what we might call the Syrian wars. That's how they're known in history, at least, these wars between the king of the north and king of the south. The top red bar that you can see here gives us the names of the kings of the north. And as you can see, we've tried to put a bit of a face to the name. So these are the various kings of the north, and the blue bar at the bottom are the kings of the south. These kings, as you can see, battled with each other for over 150 years. And the fact that they're called the kings of the north and the south meant that as they battled for possession of this territory here, which is known as the Levant, Palestine became their battlefield. And if it wasn't their battlefield, it was a place where both marauding armies would get their supplies from. And you can imagine the impact of that 150 years of war upon the Jewish people. That was punishment by God for their waywardness. Now, there were six major wars between the king of the north and the king of the south. And I'm not going to give any detail about those six wars, except for the second war, because it, for two reasons. One is that it'll give us a little bit of an insight into the level of detail and accuracy of the prophecy in chapter 11, but also it's a lead into the first war that's recorded in Daniel chapter 11. You may remember that the first Syrian war that we have on the screen here, took place between 274 and 271 BC, and the king of the south was successful. And as a result, Ptolemy extended his rule into parts of Asia Minor. That's pretty much all we want to say about that first war. I'm going to say a little bit more about the second war for the reasons that I mentioned earlier. It took place between about 260 and 253 BC, and this time the king of the north was the one that gained. Antiochus II, together with the Macedonian king, one of Alexander's other generals, Antigonus II, combined to push Ptolemy out of the Aegean. And the war concluded around 253 BC with the marriage of Berenice, Ptolemy's daughter. So a marriage between Ptolemy's daughter and Antiochus Theos, I believe it was. It was either Antiochus Theos or... it would have been Antiochus Theos, yes. So the war concluded with an arranged marriage between Berenice, Ptolemy's daughter, to Antiochus. Berenice is the king's daughter mentioned in verse 6. But the arranged marriage didn't end well. You see, Antiochus now had two wives, Berenice, the daughter of Ptolemy's, and Laodice, who he divorced to marry Berenice. Now think about this. Both marriages produced a child. If you were the first wife and you have now found out that your child is not going to inherit the throne, how would you feel? Well, Laodice didn't feel too good about that. And so she decided that she was going to make a few arrangements to make that happen. And we read of those arrangements in verse 6. And in the end of years, they, that is the king of the north and south, shall join themselves together. For the king's daughter of the south, Berenice, shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of the arm of her father. Neither shall she stand, nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. Not easy to understand, is it? But actually it's quite simple when you know the history. So what happened? As we said, the first wife wasn't happy that her son was not going to inherit the throne. And so what did she do? Well, she murdered the child of the second marriage. But why stop there? She also murdered her first husband, or her husband. Why stop there? She murdered his new wife as well. And to make things clean and simple, she also murdered the entourage that brought Berenice from Egypt to Antioch. So I think if I was married to Laodice, I would learn to sleep with my eyes open. So you can well imagine how Egypt reacted to their princess and their entourage being murdered. They declared war on the king of the north. And that's the first war that's recorded in the Bible, but it's actually the third war so far as history is concerned. Here it is here in the time of Callinicus and Euergetes. So Euergetes declared war on Laodice's newly crowned son, Callinicus, in 246 BC and took an enormous booty from Cilicia and Syria. And in exchange for peace in 241 BC, Ptolemy was awarded new territories on the northern coast of Syria. This was when you might say the Ptolemaic power was at its height. Well, the wars didn't end there. There was yet another war, the fourth Syrian war, in which the king of the south won. It was known as the Battle of Raphia, and if you'd like to look it up in your own time, it really gives you an insight just into just how many lives were lost in these battles. Like, you know, two armies of 40 or 50,000 facing each other, and in the space of 48 hours, they pretty much wipe out half of each other's army. Just mass bloodshed in these wars. So this fourth Syrian war, known as the Battle of Raphia, which was fought near, modern-day Gaza, It was the largest battle ever since the Battle of Ipsus, which was over 80 years earlier. And in about 217 BC, Ptolemy engaged and defeated Antiochus and preserved his control over Syria. The Fifth Syrian War, between 202 and 195, was won by the King of the North. It was also known as the Battle of Pennium. And on that occasion, Antiochus delivered a crushing blow to Ptolemy's near the head of the River Jordan. And one of the outcomes was that Antiochus completed the subjugation of Syria in 198 BC and took control of Judea and retained control until the time of the Romans. The sixth and final Syrian War actually had four battles. And the intervention of Rome in Egypt ended the war and prevented Antiochus from crushing Egypt once and for all. So we might ask the question, what happened in this period here between verse 14 and verse 21? Well, you see, this section covers a war not between the king of the north and the king of the south, but a war between the king of the north and Rome. On that occasion, the king of the north lost, Rome won, and as a consequence, the king of the north was forced to vacate pretty much all of Asia Minor. You may recall from Daniel chapter 8 that Asia Minor was given to the king of Pergamos as a reward for helping the Romans against Antiochus the Great. Subsequently, the king of Pergamos bequeathed Asia Minor to Rome. And this event was what the Bible styles the little horn coming out of one of the horns. Rome intervened in Egypt on two occasions, during the reign of Antiochus the Great and Antiochus the Fourth. And on both occasions, they prevented the Seleucid kings from invading Egypt, which they protected. So we might ask the question, what was the outcome of all of these wars? Quite simply this, the two horns fought for control over the Levant from 322 BC to 168 BC, a period of 155 years, and neither side ever completely won. But what the war produced was two much weakened countries who subsequently fell to Rome. And as historians have said, if only the two could have reconciled their differences, potentially they could have kept Rome at bay, but that wasn't God's will, of course. So these two powers battled it out for 150 years until eventually they were so weak that Rome plucked both of them off. During that period, as we've said, Judah was subject to the marauding forces that passed across the Levant. And from 198 BC to 142 BC, Judea was ruled by the Seleucids. We now come to the third section of chapter 11, which covers verses 30 to 35. And as I said, our intention was only to deal with that historical part quite briefly. And I'm sure if we had time to look at that more carefully, what we would discover are some wonderful types that come out of that part of Scripture. Let's just remind ourselves where these six verses 30 to 35, fit chronologically in Scripture. They're just this small section here of 7 years after what we've previously read. We've been looking at verses 5 to 29, which take us up to about 167 BC. This section covers from about 167 to 160 BC. Now, as I said before, you'll note that the record it's not interested in covering the remainder of these two dynasties. It wants to just focus on this 7 year period here, a period known in history as the Maccabean Wars, for a very good reason. So think about this. The first 29 verses cover 370 years. These next six verses cover just 7 years. That's telling us that there's something very special about this period of history, or this period of Daniel, that we want to learn from. What we're going to do is we're going to look at the historical background to these group of verses, then we're going to look at the spiritual application of them. As we said, this period of history, these 7 years, are known by historians as the Maccabean Wars, so named after the family that revolted against the Seleucid king Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, the trigger event for this conflict, these Maccabean Wars, is given to us in verses 29 to 30. Verse 29, at the time appointed, he, that is the king of the north, shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. So this is the sixth Syrian war here, and it's the last invasion of the sixth Syrian war, the fourth invasion, in fact. So Antiochus Epiphanes goes down into Egypt for the fourth time in this war, but he's not met with success like he was before. There's something that happened, and we're told about that something in verse 30. For the ships of Shittim shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So what happened? In 168 BC, Epiphanes marched on Egypt with a massive army. He had enough to get rid of Egypt once and for all. And so his intention was to annex Egypt. His army was within a few miles of Alexandria. And you may recall this, Brother Neville dealt with some of this on Sunday afternoon. So Epiphanes was within a few miles of Alexandria, and he was met by an unexpected delegation. A delegation from Rome. You see, what had happened was that the king of Egypt, Ptolemies, had appealed to Rome for help because he had intelligence to know that Antiochus was coming with an army that he could not be successful against. The Roman Senate agreed to provide help, and they dispatched with haste an envoy. His name was Gaius Papilius Lanus. And the timing of his arrival was no doubt providential. So this man left Rome in haste, got a ship in Shittim, sailed to Alexandria, got there just in time as Epiphanes was about to take Alexandria. What happened? Well, Papilius was actually known to Antiochus because Antiochus lived for quite a bit of his life in Rome, and so they got to know each other. But this meeting wasn't as he expected. Papilius made known to Antiochus the decree of the Senate. Antiochus, the Senate has sent me to tell you that you are to withdraw from Egypt. Do not fight with Egypt. And Antiochus asked for some time to consider the matter. And while he was standing there, Papilius drew a line in the sand around Antiochus and said, Antiochus, before you step outside that circle, make up your mind what you're going to do and tell me, because I want to convey it back to the Roman Senate. And hence we get the saying, the line in the sand. Antiochus had messed with the Romans not too long before and was defeated. He knew what that would mean if he took on the Romans. So he agreed. But the outcome had catastrophic consequences for Judea, the consequences that we read of in verses 30 to 35. Why is that? Well, you see, Antiochus was furious that he could not exercise his will in Egypt, so he was going to do it in Judea instead. Now, just to put some context around this, for about 20 years, the Jews had been under Seleucid rule, but they had largely ignored Greek culture. But Antiochus was determined to change that. Notice what we're told in verse 29. I'm trying to find the verse where we're told. Oh, sorry, verse 28. We're told this about Antiochus Epiphanes. His heart shall be against the covenant. This man not only hated God, he was anti-Semitic. and he was determined to replace Jewish culture with Greek culture. How did he attempt to do that? Verse 31, "And arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate." So what he did was he defiled the temple by sending troops into the temple. They removed the daily sacrifice, installed a statue of Jupiter, and set up a strong garrison to command it. On his return to Antioch, and remember he's coming back from Egypt back to Antioch, once he got back to Antioch, he issued a decree requiring all of his subjects to conform to these rules. He caused the Sabbath to be profaned. He forbade circumcision, burned all the copies of the law and the prophets that he could get his hands on, put to death anyone who acted contrary to his decree, erected idols in every city, planted sacred groves, and on his birthday, everyone was commanded to eat swine's flesh. As verse 32 says, "Such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries." Sadly, he found support within the Jewish community. What's this verse talking about? Well, what happened was he accepted a bribe from a man called Jason. Jason wanted to become high priest. What did Antiochus get in return for it? Basically, town planning approval to put a gymnasium right next to the temple. And as you might know, the Greek word gymno means suggests nudity, and nudity was compulsory in the gymnasium. And attendance by adult males was expected. In summary, Antiochus wanted to extirpate the culture of the Jews. He wanted them to lose their identity and assimilate Greek culture. Well, what effect do you think that might have had on the Jews? Well, it was mixed. Because of the benefits of Greek culture, especially economic integration, many Jews accepted the decree of Antiochus. But not all. The indignation that Antiochus unleashed on Judea had the effect of revealing those who understood their God and those who didn't. And I forgot to just put the remainder of that slide on before we move on. On two occasions, Rome acted to protect Egypt from Seleucid invasions, as recorded in Daniel 11, verse 14 and 30. The interference by Rome, as we've said, caused Antiochus to be grieved and return to Syria, as he returned to Syria. And as he passed through Palestine, he detached 20,000 troops under Apollonius to destroy Jerusalem. We're going to look a bit more closely now at these group of verses from verse 30 to 35. There are three groups of people, brothers and sisters and young people, described in those group of verses. The first are those that do wickedly. They willfully departed from God's ways and even collaborated with Antiochus, as we read in verse 30. Notice what it was that God points out about that group of people. They had broken his covenant. In other words, they obeyed the covenant or the edict that Antiochus made rather than God's. In other words, they were elevating man above God. There was the other group who remained faithful. And what is it that about that group that Scripture brings out to us? In all three references to that group, we're told that they were the ones that understood their God. That's why they were different. And not only that, we're told in verse 33 that they instructed many. They knew the importance of education. But there was yet a third group, of whom we read in verse 34, "Many shall cleave to them with flatteries." Now that word flatteries only occurs four times, and it means very smooth, treacherous. And in verse 21, it's used to describe the way in which Antiochus became king. What it's telling us is this group weren't genuine. They simply backed the winner. They were prepared to flip-flop their views to stay in favour with the majority, whoever that majority might be. They were untrustworthy, they were chameleon, and they would change their views if they had to. But there was a family who knew their God, and that was the family of Mattathias. In 167 BC, when Antiochus sent one of his officers to a little village called Modin to lay down his laws, he was met by the local Jewish country priest named Mattathias. This was to be a very portentous meeting. Mattathias was ordered to offer a sacrifice to an idol. He refused. Another Jewish man stood forward to comply with the request of the officer. When he did that, Mattathias stepped forward and slew the officer there and then on the spot. That was a turning point in the history of the nation. The Jews then rallied around Mattathias and his five sons. That family became the spiritual leaders of the nation. And the family of Mattathias became known as the Maccabees, which is a Hebrew word for hammer. That's what they were known as. And so what they did was they recruited Jews and they began a guerrilla warfare against Antiochus. We're told in verse 34, "Now when they shall fall, they shall be holpen with a little help." And when you read the accounts of these wars of the Maccabees, it's what we're being told here in verse 34, that this help that was provided, identified as a little help, was actually divine help provided by the angels. And on one occasion, the Maccabees were confronted by an army of 80,000 of Antiochus's men. 80,000. And the Maccabees and their adherents conquered them. It was divine assistance given to this family and those that followed them, remarkably outnumbered and still were victorious. Well, over a period of 7 years, they managed to beat down Antiochus. Now, keep in mind that this is the same Antiochus Epiphanes that went down into Egypt and would have conquered Egypt. He had the strength to do that, but he was defeated by the Maccabees, a remarkable feat. And at the end of the 7 years, they rededicated the temple, and their celebrations continued for 8 days, and those celebrations became known as Hanukkah, which means dedication. But the victory came at a cost. As we read, many of the righteous fell by the sword and by flame and by captivity. God tried them, as he said here, to purge them and to make them white for the time of the end. It's not hard, brothers and sisters and young people, to see what the spiritual application is of these group of five verses. We've considered the historical context, but what are the lessons for us? Well, the first thing is, I think, the most fundamental thing is to recognise a trial for what it is. Antiochus tried to Hellenize his subjects, that means to impose Greek culture upon them. That was a trial that God allowed, that they which are approved might be made manifest among you. You know, we're faced with the same trial, to conform to this world. And the question is, do we see it as a trial? Or do we see it as an excuse to change our way of life or to change our wardrobe? The second point is understanding. The thing that differentiated, the point that God differentiated Mattathias and his family from the others was that they understood their God. Not everyone did. The man that stepped forward, that was prepared to offer the sacrifice to the idol, didn't understand his God. How we understand God will determine how we act in time of trial and whether or not we're prepared to make compromises. The third point is about covenants. God takes seriously the breaking of the covenant. Think about it. Back in chapter 9, we read about how the Messiah would be cut off in order that the covenant might be confirmed. So if, brothers and sisters and young people, we break God's covenant, that's equivalent to treading underfoot the blood of Christ. Two final points. Education. Those that understood instructed many. They recognised that education was really the key to transformation. As the Apostle Paul wrote, be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind. And the final point, I think, to take away is about acquiescing. One historian wrote this: many Jewish people fell in line and acquiesced to the regime. If you don't know what acquiesce means, it means to assent tacitly, to submit or comply silently without protest. And I believe, brothers and sisters and young people, that acquiescing is the greatest threat facing the Brotherhood today. To acquiesce to changing values. It's so easy to go with the flow, isn't it? To maintain acceptance and popularity. And if our reason for doing something is simply because that's what everyone else is doing, that's not good enough. That's not a good enough reason for making a decision. If we're faced with change, it's reasonable and it's wise to ask two questions. Is it biblically based and is it an improvement? Fathers and mothers, don't be like the man that stepped forward and was prepared to compromise and to offer a sacrifice to the idol. Be courageous like Mattathias. Be prepared to stand up and in some cases to say no. Young people, if your parents are saying no to Antiochus, accept that it's for your eternal welfare. And one day, God willing, you'll look back on your past and be thankful for what your parents have done. That then brings us to the next and final section that we want to deal with tonight, verses 36 to 39. But before we do, I just want to pause for a moment and to reflect upon these last two sections that we're dealing with tonight. That is, verses 30 to 35 is one section, and verses 36 to 39. So think about this for a moment. We've seen from a previous slide about the number of kings that there were in the kings in the dynasty of the north and south. Why is it that from verse 21 through to verse 30 is dealing with just one king, one of the kings, one of the Seleucid kings, Antiochus Epiphanes? He only ruled for 13 years, but he occupies all of those verses. What's the reason for that? This is a eulogy of this man. On one occasion, as recorded in Daniel 11, verse 28, he plundered Jerusalem, murdered 80,000 Jews, took 40,000 prisoner, and sent an equal number into captivity. He was the epitome of cruelty. Not only that, he made decrees that were designed to extirpate Jewish belief and way of life. His heart, as it says, was against the covenant. Epiphanes was a hater of God and his people. Why is this man so prominent in this record, such a diabolical monster? Well, I think the answer is that in this group of verses from verse 30 to 39, we have provided for us a portrait a portrait of the king who is going to be Gog at the time of the end. As Brother Thomas says, Gog will be as impious and cruel as Antiochus Epiphanes and as superstitious and fanatical as Justinian. And we're going to see in a little while that Justinian, who was one of the Byzantine emperors, is typical of the king who's described in verses 36 to 39. In other words, verses 30 to 39 give us a complete portrait of Gog at the time of the end. So, as I said, when we come now to verse 36, we're coming to a new section from verses 36 to 39. And it marks a significant change in the prophecy. So whereas in verses 30 to 35, we have the description of Antiochus who is suppressing religion, we've got the opposite in verses 36 to 39, where it describes a king who is sponsoring religion. There's no longer a mention of the king of the north or the king of the south, just simply in verse 36, the king. And it's essential to get a clear understanding of who this king or what this king represents if we're going to interpret verse 40, which has to do with the time of the end. Most commentators would agree on the interpretation of the first 35 verses, but once they get to verse 36, that's where there is a significant divergence in understanding. Most would say that the king referred to in verse 36 is still Antiochus Epiphanes. It's this person here that we've just spoken about. But there's a number of reasons why that's not so, as we'll touch on as we go through. So to help us to get a right angle on these verses, I want to go back to Daniel chapter 8 just for a moment. Let's turn back to Daniel chapter 8. In Daniel chapter 8, we're introduced in verse 9 to the little horn. One, as it says, and out of one of them came forth a little horn. And we're told that that little horn waxed exceedingly great towards the south, east, and toward the west. Verse 10 to 12 describe the operations of that little horn during the first 200 years of its existence. This was during the Roman phase, when it crucified the Messiah, as verse 11 says. It magnified itself even to the prince of the host. Jump across to verse 23. Verse 23 to 27 continue to describe the career of the little horn. Verse 23 goes on to describe the little horn in its Roman phase. But when we get to verse 25, which is the terminal phase of the little horn, where it contends with the prince of the princes, that is Christ and the saints, it's destroyed. So clearly, in this phase, the little horn is not Roman, but Russian. So how do we answer the question, within the space of one or two verses, the identity of this little horn changes from being Roman to Russian? Well, the answer is quite simple, that God wants us to view the little horn as a role, not as an identity. Think of the little horn as a role in a play. It doesn't matter who the person is that plays the role, it's the role that matters. And in scene one, the part is played by a person called Roman. In scene two, the part is played by a person called Russia. Now, I want you to keep that principle in mind, and let's go back to Daniel chapter 11. Now, in the same way that the little horn in Daniel chapter 8 is to be viewed as a role play, so too is the king in verse 36. You might call it a role play. And that role play goes for a long time, for we read in verse 36 that he prospers till the indignation against Israel be accomplished. That indignation ends in chapter 12, verse 1. So in other words, the career of this king extends right through until the time of the end. Well, what else do we know about the king? The king is also the hymn in verse 40. So it's a good exercise to highlight all of the references to from verse 36 through to verse 40 to the he and the him, because they're all referring to the king. So the king of verse 36, just to say it again, is the him in verse 40. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him. That's the king of verse 36. What else do we know about this king? Well, it's a power that downtreads Israel, so it's a military power. It shows indignation against Israel. And finally, this power makes divine pretensions, for we're told that he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god. So what power is there that could answer to this role? The answer is Rome. Rome has the role play of the king in scene one. So how does Rome fit that description? Well, let's think about it. In 65 BC, Judea came under Roman control and subject to increasing indignation until finally Judah was crushed in AD 70. In latter years, from 313 AD onwards, the Roman emperors promoted the bishops of Rome, who then gained power and asserted themselves as the mother of all churches and God as the Pope as God's representative on earth. So having absorbed all of the countries around the Mediterranean, Rome became imperially enthroned in Constantinople as the capital of the eastern section of the empire. So in other words, Rome enthroned in Constantinople is the only power that this could apply to. Now think about this. It follows that if Rome is the king in its initial phase, and Rome is the little horn in its initial phase, then the king and the little horn are one and the same. In other words, the king of verse 36 is the little horn of the goat in Daniel chapter 8. Now, Brother Thomas in Exposition of Daniel makes a very important observation or deduction, we might say, about this king. And when explaining this section of verses 36 to 39, he titles it the Constantinopolitan Autocrat. In other words, the autocrat of Constantinople. And his deduction of the king in verse 36, or his deduction, sorry, that the king of verse 36 would be enthroned in Constantinople is a very astute one, because there's no direct reference to Constantinople in the Bible. And the importance of that deduction is evident by the fact that in his exposition, 16 times in that section, he emphasises that the king would be of Constantinople. And so, as we'll see next week, that greatly assists our interpretation of verses 40 to 45. I don't have time to go into the reasoning of how Brother Thomas concluded that, but if you'd like to see me afterwards, I'm happy to tell you. Basically, the kernel of it is this, that Constantinople is the throne of the little horn of the goat. So before we look more closely at Rome in verses 36 to 39, let's trace the emergence of this little horn. So you remember when we had the slide, the breakup of the chapter, we had a picture there of a goat with four horns, and two horns of interest were the Seleucid and the Ptolemaic horn, and out of one of them came forth a little horn, Rome. So how does Rome appear? It's got to be in chapter 11 somewhere. How does it emerge out of the record? Well, let's just quickly look at the places where it occurs. You might like to highlight these. So this is the emergence of the little horn of the goat in Daniel 11. It occurs in verse 14 and verse 18. In the interest of time, we won't go into the details. You can perhaps get this off me later or copy it off the online version. So they're the first two occurrences of Rome in chapter 11, but there's two more. Brother Neville covered one of these on Sunday. The ships of Chittim doesn't actually refer to Rome, but you remember that the Roman envoy came in the ships of Chittim. And of course, the king that we've just spoke about in verse 36, which is a role play, and the first person to play that role is Rome. And the king is initially the emperor's of the Christian Roman Empire. And that's important. Not the pagan Roman Empire, but the Christian Roman Empire. So, in summary, chapter 11, verses 36 to 39 is an amplification of the little horn of the goat in chapter 8, but with an important difference. In chapter 8, in those verses that we looked at, it describes the little horn in its pagan Roman phase, whereas in chapter 11, it describes the little horn in its Christian Roman phase, and that's important to note that difference. And the transition between the two went something like this, that in 313 AD, following the Battle of Milvian Bridge, Constantine made Christianity the state religion. Around 330 AD, he moved his civil and military capital to Constantinople. In 395, the empire became formally divided between East and West. So for a period of time, there were actually two emperors. Well, you know what happened next? In 476 AD, the empire in the West was overcome. What subsequently happened was that this emperor wanted to still retain power over this territory. How was he to do it? Well, what he did was he promoted the profile of the Bishop of Rome to the point where he became very strong. And we know the story from there on. So that's sort of the background to what's happening here and will help us to understand verses 36 to 39 more easily. So the emperor gave power and authority to the papal system. And I'd like you to note this, hence, whatever was done by the papal power is said to be done by the king. And we see examples of that in verses 36 and 37. Okay, let's have a closer look at verses 36 to 39. We're told about this king. It's the little horn of the goat throned in Constantinople, as we've said. The second thing we're told is that he would exalt himself and magnify himself. In order to further his power, the king will exalt himself by magnifying his role as patron of the religious administrator of his dominion. I know that's a bit of a mouthful, but that's the essence of what it means for him to exalt himself. Furthermore, we're told that he would prosper till the indignation be accomplished. The little horn, in other words, would continue until the time of the end. Next, we're told that he would not regard the God of his fathers. The king shall not regard the pagan gods of his forefathers. And finally, we're told that he would, nor have the desire of women. The king will patronize a high priest that forbids to marry. It goes on to tell us in verses 38 and 39, in his estate shall he honor the God of forces. The word forces there is a Hebrew word which means fortresses. And the supposed guardian or saints are a fortress to those who believe in them. That's the idea of what's being said here. So in other words, the king will honour the Bishop of Rome, who is the chief pontiff of these guardian saints. That's the idea of God of forces. We're also told that he would honour them with gold, silver and precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds. The word strong there is the Hebrew word basar, and it means an enclosed or covered marketplace. Langhertz interprets it as temples. In other words, the king will do for temples what he will do for the bishop or God of guardians. He will bestow many gifts upon them, as Justinian did in building Saint Sophia. And as I alluded to earlier, if you want an example of an emperor who fulfilled the role of verses 36 to 39, Justinian is your man. He was one of the Byzantine emperors. It goes on to say that he would do this with a strange god, which, as we've said, a god of Christian emperors was strange to their pagan predecessors. He shall cause them to rule over many. The priests were given authority over all ranks of society. And finally, they would divide the land for gain. The lands were divided between the priests for gain. So we can see the remarkable level of detail here of what we're being told about the little horn in its Christian Roman phase. Well, there is another application of these verses that we want to deal with very briefly, and that is the application to the latter day king. As we said, this king is going to have continuance right through until the indignation ends in Daniel chapter 12 and verse 1. It's a role play. Rome was the one to play the role at first, but in scene 2, the identity of the king changes to Russia. What we're told of the king in verses 36 to 39, therefore, must, we would expect, have application to Russia. And in the last generation, we've seen remarkable things happen in Russia, and I'd just like to share some of those with you. We want to look at now at, we've considered how the king will prosper religion. Let's have a focus now on Russia and look at what's changed. Think about if we go back to 1930, and if Brother Ron Smithers was here when he was born, if he was reading books in Russia, this is what he might see in those books. It's a depiction of the struggle of socialism against religion. And you can see religion is depicted as getting in the way of prosperity and progress. That's 1930. Step forward to 1975, another Russian poster, this time a cosmonaut walking in space and saying, "Can't see any God." It was a deliberate program by the Russians to try and remove Christianity from the empire. This year in Russia, as you may have heard if you're listening into Brother Neville on Sunday afternoon, Putin, in the space of a couple of years, has built a new military cathedral. Lenin would have turned over in his grave if he had seen this on the outskirts of Moscow. It's one of the tallest in the country, one of the tallest cathedrals in the country. At the inauguration of the temple, there was a speech given by these two men. They are the top religious and military men in the country. Look at what they have to say. This is what the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church said. "With this harmony," don't you love that word? "With this harmony between the might of the armed forces and the spiritual might of the church, of the spiritual and the material, of the church and state, let the path of our people go into the future in peace and prosperity. And of this path, God willing, let there be new victories, new achievements, and no defeats." I've done a copy-paste error here. This guy's not the Russian Orthodox Patriarch. He doesn't really look the same as this guy. This is the head of military. He says, "I am absolutely sure that all those who will come here will remember our country's past heroic deeds and prepare for future feats." What a remarkable change that's taken place, brothers and sisters and young people, in the last 100 years that we've been able to witness. You know, not everybody in Russia is oblivious to what's going on. This Russian, he's a Soviet military analyst, had this to say. Think about this in the light of what we've just read in verses 36 to 39. "This is not about religion. This is for the army. As current military and state leaders think, Russia needs an ideology." That's straight out of verses 36 to 39. "We need political control over the armed forces. And since, for the time being, official ideology is prohibited, they invented that Russian Orthodox faith will be an imitation of such an ideology. I think that's just remarkable, and we're able to see that coming to pass. In conclusion, brothers and sisters and young people, when we take a step back from this chapter, we must be struck by this fact that everything has taken place in this chapter except for the last section of the chapter. It won't be long before verses 41 to 45 will be deemed as history. The question is, where will we be then? The other final point I'd like to make is this, that the Maccabees were purged and made white for the time of the end. We can't escape that purging process. Ours won't be like theirs, but we will go through a process. They will rise to participate in overthrowing that king of the north. If we expect to be involved in overcoming the world, then we must be prepared to do what they did and to submit to God's purging hand. Our closing hymn, hymn 310, aptly describes the experience of the Maccabees, the qualities that will befit those to be clad in robes of purest whiteness. These are they who have contended for their saviours on along, wrestling on till life was ended, following not the sinful throng. These who well the fight sustained, triumph through the Lamb have gained.